DFW History Project, and I am with Mr. Charles C. Wirth at his home on Spate Street in Madison, and today is March 13th, 1984. Mr. Wirth, what years did you attend UW?
1937, September to April of 1944.
Now that's about 7 years.
Yes, I was a let's put it this way, a rather slow student because I am blind and I had to I went most of the time on a reduced schedule.
Okay, well let's start out talking about your visual handicap. Were there many other blind students on campus?
Yes, there were several of them. And we used to get together quite frequently down on Sterling Court. One of them had an apartment down there, and we used to get together very frequently, have little bowl sessions and what have you.
How many is very many? Can you give an estimate on numbers?
Oh, there were at least five of us.
At least five. What type of adaptations did your professors, what type of adaptations, if any, did your professors and instructors make toward your visual impairment?
Well, they would give us extra time if we could write in the normal manner, because if we wrote much slower than other people. Some of them would give us an oral exam, and there were others who would really give us an individual type examination, quite different than what they gave the rest of the class. I had a professor by the name of Thwaites,
mm-hmm.
He was in the geography department, and I was taking the physical geography of the United States, and I just could not read a map. He would give me examinations, and he would also kind of prep me for the examination by explaining the map and telling me exactly the shapes of the various areas and that kind of thing, so that I had a pretty good idea of what I was dealing with.
Did he do this on his own time during his office hours?
On his own time, yes. He was a very fine gentleman.
What type of cooperation did you generally get from your other instructors?
It was usually very good, sometimes it was it was done in a manner that, well, here's the examination, and you just take as much time as you want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there any student services at that time available to visually impaired people out of the dean's office or anywhere else?
No, not as a university per se, but there was a blind readers fund that one could apply to, which came out of Janesville,
mm-hmm.
out of the school down there.
Yeah.
And you got an allotment per month to pay for people to read to you. And in my senior year, the girls at Delta Gamma notified me that I had been adopted by their sorority, and that any time I wanted a reader, all I had to do was call, and they would send a girl over for me.
Did you ever take them up on it?
I sure did, they were extremely cooperative, never disappointed me. The people they sent were of very superior quality.
Now, this was a social sorority or a professional sorority? No.
This I do not know.
Well, I can.
It's Delta Gamma, yeah. And they were located on Langdon Street, very, very close to Kennedy Manor.
One other question that doesn't have to do with you, but maybe some other students at UW during this period. Were there other handicapped students on campus in the time period that you were on? I'm talking about physically handicapped or hearing impaired or anything like that that you were aware of?
I wasn't aware of.
Okay. What was your status? You were an undergraduate during that time.
Except for about a year, I was scheduled to graduate in December, but I elected to take my degree in June. Mm-hmm. So I could have graduated in December, but I let it slide for 6 months, and so I did take a few graduate courses.
What was your major?
Sociology. And at that time, the Department of Social Work was in the Department of Sociology, and I was preparing to be a social worker.
Okay, let's backtrack a little bit to before you came to UW. Where did you go to high school?
Well, I went three. My parents lived for a brief time in Oak Park, Illinois, and I went to Fenwick High School, which is a private, let's say, Catholic school in Oak Park. I went there for 3 years, and then we moved back to Madison. I completed my senior year at Madison East.
Oh, you did. So then you elected to go to UW at that point.
Oh, that's. I wanted to go to the University of Wisconsin from time I was entered high school.
Why?
I don't know. I had always lived in Madison, and I was. Ardent football fan, so I wanted to be a Badger from the very beginning.
Did you have any trouble getting into Madison?
No, I didn't have any trouble. There was just a little flurry in the beginning because the dean looked up my records, of course, through high school, and they weren't particularly high. And he found an IQ test that I took in my senior year in high school, and I had an IQ of 80. And, he pointed that up and said, well, you can never make it through the University of Wisconsin. Well, I got around that. I took a IQ test off the university, and that kind of cleared it up. I had, well, like so many young people, I just fooled at it, you know, in high school.
Who was the dean? Is this Dean Goodnight?
No, this was Dean Rudicelli.
Oh, he's from LNS.
That's right.
Okay.
A little story I can tell you about that. I dealt primarily with Dean Rudicelli and Dean Glicksman in the LNS school. Now, the difference between the men was that Dean Glicksman had a way of talking to you that you weren't antagonized. Mm-hmm. But Dean Rudicelli was considerably younger, well, he had he was kind of a bull terrier. He would snap at you and had the ability to antagonize you rather than have you go away feeling halfway right. You were antagonized when you got done with him. And I made up my mind that I was going to get my degree, and when I got my degree, I was going to take it and plunk it on his desk and say, now, I've done it. Here is a degree from the University of Wisconsin. And I did it.
You did? What'd he say?
Well, he muttered something, oh, that's fine. I'm so glad for you.
So you never really considered going to any other colleges?
No.
Where did you live your first year? Or when you left? When you started, you didn't?
I lived here in Madison. I lived on the east side.
Not with your family?
Yes, so I lived with my I lived with my folks all through the university.
Okay, fine.
In fact, we lived in this neighborhood, but not in this house.
What type of orientation did you get when you entered the city?
Well, they took us down to the Stock Pavilion and talked to us, you know, the whole class as a group.
Mm-hmm. Who is they? Anyone in particular? Or just
well, the president of the university and a couple of the deans and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And then we had a tour of the campus. They took us in small groups, and this is Langdon Hall. No, this is Science Hall, and this is North Hall, and that's South Hall, and so on. They took us around to the various buildings on campus and identified them for us.
So it doesn't sound like a terribly in-depth orientation?
No.
Okay.
And of course, they took us down to the Memorial Union, and it was more of a rah-rah kind of thing. That's what it was.
Where did you go in the Union? In Great Hall?
No, we were down in the Ratskeller.
Yeah.
You remember, it wasn't a very big
class. That's right. How big are we talking about here?
Well, I really can't relate how large the freshman class was, but there was only maybe 6,000 students in 1937, approximately.
So they could take them all around in one group, you know?
No, they split us up in groups of 25 or 30. I did the same thing for freshman class when I was a senior.
Oh, you mean you had student tour guides?
Yeah,
I
participated as a student tour guide of the university, identifying the buildings.
Tell me about course selection for the first semester.
Well, of course, we had a kind of catalog of courses available, and you were assigned to an advisor, and you went to the advisor, and you pretty much told him what he told you what you had to have, and you told him what you'd like to have, and you came to a meeting of minds on it.
So he just more or less advised you of your requirements.
That's right.
And who was your freshman advisor, do you remember?
Don't remember.
Okay. Did you have a faculty advisor later on? Or a major professor, whatever you want to call him?
After I got through with my sophomore year, yes, I had a man by the name of McCormick, mm-hmm. who was the head of the Department of Sociology.
Mm-hmm. And he was your advisor for the next 2 years?
Yes.
Did he, how much time did you actually spend with him?
Not a great deal. He saw to it that I had my requirements and that the grades were satisfactory.
That was the extent of his?
Yeah.
Okay. And was that pretty much the way it was after your sophomore year? You picked up an advisor then?
That's right.
Okay.
Before that, we were assigned to an advisor, but for the time we spent with him, it wasn't over 20 minutes a semester.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I suspect he might have had a great number of students.
Yes, he probably he did. He had quite a number.
When you registered for classes, describe the registration process. Where you went and what you did.
Well, the registration, I remember where we went to pay our fees, which was on the corner of Park and University, which was the purser's office, or what you would call where you went to pay for your fee card, which was $42.50 at that time. Mm-hmm. Well, and it didn't. But let's see, where
did you go to the Red Gym, or you remember?
No.
Was the purser's office in the president's old house there? Is that still standing at that time? Or is that part of the union?
No. Right on the corner of...
Park and University.
No. Park and State Street, right? State on the corner of Park and State. Okay. It was kind of a yellow brick building. It didn't stand out very much. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of a... but that's where you went to pay your fees. And I think... where we went to sign up for the courses was I think they had 1 year they had a set up in Great Hall, and then again we had each department. You went from department to department in the various buildings. Mm-hmm. This was the usual way.
Getting your stamps.
Yeah.
Your signatures.
Yeah.
You mentioned before that you selected sociology as your major and with social work as your specialty. When did you start thinking about a major?
I think I went in with the idea of getting into social work.
When did you get that idea initially? Do you remember when you started thinking about that? High school or before?
Well, I think I started to think about it in high school. I was always rather interested in social issues, and somewhere along the line I picked up that social workers were really active in that kind of thing. And I liked economics, I liked civics, and I liked history, the field of sociology kind of encompassed all of them.
I see. So you came pretty well set. When did you declare your major?
At the end of my sophomore year.
And again, that was pretty much the way it was done?
Yeah.
So your first 2 years were pretty much just taking the general requirements for...
That's right. The sophomore year, I started taking the introductory to sociology, introductory to psychology, that kind of thing. The first year, there was English and history and that kind of thing. It filled up the schedule.
I see. So, you declared it after your sophomore year. When you went... During your years in school, how were male students generally expected to dress?
Well, as far as I remember, there was no real set standard. Most of them dressed in slacks and shirt or slacks and jacket. A bigger share of them wore a necktie.
Okay, now that was in 1937. Did that continue all the way through your undergraduate years there? Okay.
That's right.
Okay, so it would not be unusual to see someone in a shirt and a tie, or a shirt and a tie and a sport jacket on.
That's right. They didn't, when I speak about a jacket, I'm talking about the kind of jacket that you would wear on over shirt, like you might go out today at
Okay, so there weren't that many sport coats. They were mainly just shirts and ties.
Yeah, it was shirts and ties. If you was in class, you would see fellas there with a shirt and tie and maybe a sweater on.
But it was possible to go to class without a tie.
Oh, yes.
And had not have anything. What about, like, blue jeans or anything like that, weren't they?
There were no blue jeans.
There weren't blue jeans.
They weren't in existence yet. No, I could tell you about blue jeans. They didn't start to come in until about 1944.
Right near the end of the war.
Yeah. And it was only one... I saw my first girl in a pair of slacks in about 1944.
Okay, that's the next question. What did women dress? What did girls usually dress in?
The girls, all right, dresses were number one. Mm-hmm. Number two was skirt and blouse. Mm-hmm. Never any stockings. Mm-hmm. No high heels, though. They were kind of flat. Mm-hmm. Winter or summer, it didn't matter. They were still bare-legged. I remember I used to stand at the foot of Bascom Hall and watch the girls come down the Bascom Hill when it would be 10 below zero, and the guys would look at one another and say, well, the girls are patriotic. Their legs are red, white, and blue.
So you saw your first jeans in 1944.
Yeah.
Was it unusual at that point? Or did they start appearing quickly after that? Or
In 44, after that, they started to come in pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I saw a girl in a pair of jeans. And that girl had a chain around her leg also, which attracted quite a bit of attention.
So there was cause to talk about that person.
Oh, yes.
Dressed with her pants and with her chain.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
What was the talk? Was it what were people saying about it? Were they scandalized? Were they pleased? Were they?
Well, they laugh and say something dirty about it.
No, that kind of thought. All right. What about professors? How do they generally dress?
Most of them dressed with a suit coat. A suit coat and tie.
So it was a suit rather than a sport coat?
That's right. Okay. It was definitely a suit.
Okay.
There was one notable exception.
What's that?
And that was Hans Gert. Over in the Department of Sociology, he taught social psychology.
How did he dress?
Very much like the students did in 1969-70.
How did that go over?
There wasn't any talk about his dress, really. He'd show up from time to time with a kind of a T-shirt and... a pair of baggy pants on and lecture. And in the wintertime, he would come in his ski togs. He skied from his house to Sterling Hall. Hmm. And he'd come in his ski boots. And we used to tease him. I used to draw a picture of a guy on skis coming down a hill on the blackboard before he got into class. And then we'd go back and sit down and wait for him to come. And he'd look at it, and he never did anything. He never said a word about it, but he noticed it. I can tell you quite a few stories about Hans Gert. He was, I had him in about four different courses, because I liked the man, and... well, I could make grades there. And he gave the kind of course that I liked. His courses were more of an encyclopedic type. Everything under the sun. you didn't need to worry about his lectures turning up in your examinations one single bit. The examinations were purely on outside reading.
Mm-hmm.
In social psychology we got a bit of history, we got a feel for castle life in England in the 12th century, the days of the Medicis, the time of Johann Strauss, and so on. You got a feel of what life was like in those times by his lecture, and it was extremely interesting.
Was he popular with other students as well?
Yes, he was. The girls either loved him or hated him, and in fact, he was summoned to the dean of women's office because he said a very nasty word in class.
Oh, really?
Yes, and the poor man was absolutely blameless on it. He had lectured for a good many years at the university what's the capital of Belgium now? Well, anyway, lectured in European universities for many years. He came over here as a refugee during the war. But before that, he had spent quite a few years in European universities. Okay. Well, say for instance, when he was describing castle life in old England, he would tell what went on in the castle. And he told about the kind of parties that they would have. Mm-hmm. And they have these big banquets, very boisterous events. And they didn't have any forks. All they had was a knife and a plate. And they served their meat on enormous slices of bread. And they gobble the meat up, just cut the meat up and with their fingers, because the fork wasn't invented yet.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they drank too heavily. Well, now comes the word. Well, he said in those times, what happened was that they'd have drink an awful lot, and they'd have to relieve themselves. And they do it right under the table. He said they piss under the table. Okay. That word got him in trouble. He was summoned to the dean of women's office for that. A couple of the women took offense to him.
What happened? Do you have any idea what the dean of women might have said to him?
No. I haven't got the slightest idea. You see, this word was... is a common word in
mm-hmm.
in Europe,
sure.
And you could say it a dozen times in a lecture if you wanted to, and nobody took offense.
How did you find out that he got summoned to the dean's office? Did he say something about it?
Yes, he did say something about it.
What did he say?
Well, he kind of apologized to the class.
Mm-hmm.
By saying that this was a very commonly used word in the European universities when if you were lecturing and that particular kind of thing came up, that's the word you used there.
Do you remember? Can you date what year that occurred in? Probably be after 39 or after, right? Because it would be an advanced course.
Yes, I would say that possibly it was in 41, 42.
Early war years.
Yeah, because the class was largely made up of women.
Mm. Yes, there were 70% women during the war years.
No, he gave an explanation of how come he used the word. It was commonly used in lectures in European universities.
Can you recall any other instances where you had heard of professors being summoned to dean's offices for anything like that?
Never.
Okay, that's very, very interesting. When you were in class, how were you expected to behave?
Be quiet.
Were there ever any problems that you can recall?
No. Uh-huh. Okay. You see, we had usually two lectures and a quiz period. We went to two lectures and then on, say, on Friday or on Thursday, we went to a quiz period.
Okay. And who was in charge of the quiz period?
Usually a TA.
So they had TAs, graduate students.
That's right.
Okay. And these were how big?
The quiz period, the quiz classes were maybe 10 to 15 students.
Okay. And were classes generally co-ed throughout your?
Oh, yes.
I guess especially during the war years, you were more in the minority. Huh?
Yes, but they were from the very beginning. They were always co-ed.
Were women treated the same in terms of course expectations, access to materials, et cetera?
I certainly saw them enough in the libraries, I think they were treated just like, didn't matter whether you're male or female, you were treated very much alike.
What about, like, blacks and Jews? Did it matter if you were blacks? Oops, I think you just got a call. We'll pick this up in a minute. Okay, now we just turn the microphone back on. We're talking about possible discrimination against blacks and Jews at the university.
Well, I did some research on it. I was now it came to my attention that particularly Jewish people, there was a considerable resentment towards Jewish people on campus.
By students or faculty? Or
by students.
Okay.
There were, say, the Middle Western students, the students from Wisconsin and those that came in here from Minnesota or Iowa or Illinois. Let's call them local students, mm-hmm. so to speak. They thought that there was a terrible intrusion of the New York Jew, and they were very much disliked. Now, what happened during the war was that we had a very large influx of New York, New Jersey, Jewish people, young folks. And they were usually exceptionally bright. And now, at that time, the high school, the secondary schools in New York and New Jersey were considerably ahead of academically of the schools, say, in Wisconsin. Those people, they were bright, they had access to a superior type of education. So when they came into the university here, they had a head start. And the thing was, they looked down upon us, we thought, because they were from the big city and we were just country bumpkins. And it was resented because many of the students, local students from Wisconsin thought, well, these people are looking down on us. They regard us as hicks. And so it kind of worked both ways that way. The New Yorker kind of thought he was eminently superior, and the Wisconsin student didn't like the being thought of as a second-class student. But there was a lot of resentment. Okay, the research I did was to go to the, I think it was Dean Goodnight's department, and got the statistics where the students came from who were at that time enrolled in the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I found that it was that the number of students from New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts was exceedingly great. It amounted to better than 50% of the students who were here.
Was that during the war years?
Yes.
Huh.
It was very, very high. It all depended upon, if you just took New York, New York City, of course, that was a smaller number. But if you took all of New York State, all of New Jersey, and say all of Massachusetts, put all three of those together.
Are you working on the assumption that most people from these states were Jewish?
We worked on the assumption that most of them that came from New York and New Jersey, but the ones from whoever came from Massachusetts, we threw that in there because it was Eastern Seaboard. By the way, most of the Delta Gamma girls were from Massachusetts. And I don't know whether they were Jewish or not, but they were class people.
What about, did the anti-Semitism and the anti-Midwesternism, did it manifest itself in any way besides like just in perhaps private discussions and things like that?
I can't say that it did. There were no confrontations or any of that kind of thing. Because these Eastern people were definitely of superior intelligence, because they were very capable, they got into the concert committee that I was on. It was practically all New York people. Whether they were all Jewish or not didn't matter to me. I didn't care whether they were Jewish or not. They were always decent to me. I had no reason to quarrel with them at all. I didn't care where they were from. The Wisconsin, the students that came from Wisconsin resented the New York Jew. Mm-hmm. And those that came from New
York. Was it that specific, or did they just resent Easterners? Or did they characterize Easterners as New York Jews?
It was New York Jews, whether they came from New York or New Jersey or Massachusetts or Connecticut.
Okay.
The Eastern Jew
was resented.
Yes.
Okay. And this is something that you saw from your whole stay there.
That's
from 37 to 44.
Yes.
Did it get worse or better at any time?
Well, I didn't know during my freshman year. I didn't notice that kind of thing, but it became extremely noticeable. Let's say about just before the war, and during the war, and just the immediate time afterwards. Now, for instance, this first girl that I saw with a pair of slacks on, with a chain around her neck, was definitely a New York Jewess. There was no doubt about it. The boys said some very nasty things among about her, just from her appearance. We didn't speak to her or anything. She went into the store that we were in, and we got waited on and went out. Noticed how she was dressed, and it was very obvious that she was Jewish. Although I had a Jewish reader when I was on campus. She was a very nice girl. She had red hair and blue eyes, but she was Jewish. Her father was a rabbi.
So the anti-Semitism that was more or less there, but as far as you can see, it was confined to like just discussions amongst groups of peers.
Yes.
Did it affect, as far as you know, like dating patterns and things like that?
Would
a Midwestern boy date a Jewish girl from New Jersey, for example?
I don't think so. I never noticed it. Never seen it done. I did.
But generally, you were the exception rather than the rule.
That's right.
Okay. What about blacks? Was there any, anything you can talk about along the line? Were there many here on campus?
No, there weren't too many. There were, in the later years, say 43, 44, there were two or three black activists on campus. And they would create a scene once in a while over in the Memorial Union. And our the general attitude was when they came in and started to make their little speech about how they were put upon, everybody disappeared.
Mm. Oh, so they'd get up and talk. They just start talking out loud, or get a little forum, like stand on top of a chair and start talking?
No, they just get out in the middle of the room and address everybody that we could find.
Okay. So sort of, anyone who listened.
Although I had, in one of my classes with Hans Gerth, I had we were rather close friends. We'd go out and have a beer together. His name was Oliver Hardy, and he was from Tuskegee. He was a teacher at Tuskegee Institute. A fine gentleman. He was black as coal, but he always wore a suit and a white shirt and a necktie. Mm-hmm. And his shoes were polished. He was dressed as well as any of the professors.
Okay. Were the TAs, did they dress the same way too, with the suits and ties, pretty much, or did they vary?
Oh, they varied almost as widely as the professors. I'd say, for instance, Hans Gerth, once in a while, he would come in a suit, but not regularly. And there were other professors who would just come in shirt sleeves. But if they were giving a lecture, they always had a suit on and a necktie.
When you went to a class, what were you expected to bring?
Just your notebook and pencil and paper.
Okay. Characterize the teaching styles of most of your professors. Was it mainly lecture, or you said lecture and then discussion? Was that the typical form, or were there classes where it was combined?
It was either solid lecture for a whole period, or also was quiz period for a whole period, and that was discussion. And sometimes they'd give us a 10, 15 minutes little test on.
So when a person was up there, when Gerth or whoever was up there lecturing, it was a lecture then? There was,
that's right.
He didn't call on you or...
No. Uh-uh. Okay. It was just a lecture.
Okay. How did professors generally dress students in class, male and female students?
Well, it was those that they had more contact with... especially in a smaller group.
Mm-hmm.
It was Charlie or Roy or Mary or Jane.
Mm-hmm.
In the larger group, it was Mr. Worth and it was Miss Morgan.
What about how did students generally address professors in class?
Professors, yeah.
It wasn't Dr. or Mr., was it generally Professor?
Professor Otto, or Professor Gerth.
Okay. Were you or any of your friends ever truants?
Oh, yes.
Did you ever get caught?
The word truant, I don't understand in this context, because there was no truancy about it. In other words, if we wanted to skip a lecture, okay, you do it at your own risk.
They didn't take attendance then?
No. In the smaller quiz groups, they kind of kept track.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were missing too often, you were called on it and said, hey, look, you better get to these quiz periods. But that was it. If you missed a lecture, that was all right, but you did it at your own risk.
Was there generally a lot of memorization involved in your assignments?
It largely depended upon the course. I took some history, and I found in the history department there was a lot of memorization. But in sociology, the only thing that you memorized was, say, definitions.
What about homework? How much were you typically assigned per course per night?
Oh, boy. Ordinarily, say, for instance, in the course of history, you'd have an enormous amount of homework. You'd have not only read chapters 2, 3, and 4, but make a map of the First Crusade.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was outside reading outside of your textbook. You'd go to the library and read the encyclopedia. Or some research book on this particular item.
So it was very greatly.
Yes. Let's put it this way. My experience was that the amount of outside reading was very, very heavy, say, in history. And, medium, say, in sociology, and down to practically nil if you took a course in philosophy.
Mm. Okay, we're talking about philosophy in a little bit. How accessible were your professors outside of the classroom?
Very accessible. They had their office hours, and you could go up and see them anytime you wanted to.
During those hours.
There was no problem about it. Well, there were so few students.
Yeah. Did you ever have any contact with professors in non-academic situations?
Not really, no. I can think of one man who used to, he wasn't a professor of mine, and so I really don't remember what his name, but he used to take us out to his house, which was located on Virginia Terrace. The cemetery was in the backyard. He'd take a half a dozen us fellows out there and play pool in his basement. But I can't remember what the man's name is now.
How are course grades generally determined? Term papers, quizzes, class participation, finals?
Let's put it this way. The final examination was the big... was the big portion, and the midterm counted quite a bit, And there was a 6 weeks exam, which counted some too. And then the various quizzes along the line. It varied from course to course. I had a course in statistics where we had a midterm when we had a final exam, and the final exam was supposed to be quite critical. The professor completely wiped us out with the final exam. There wasn't anybody who passed it. Everybody got a failure in the final exam.
What are you doing?
Well, he then went back. Now we had in statistics we had this lab course, and every week we were assigned a certain number of problems by the professor, and we would bring them to the lab and turn them into the TA. And by the way, I'm exceedingly proud that he would stand at the door and take mine personally and put it on the board to show everybody how something should be done. Mm-hmm. I missed one problem during the whole semester. And he put it up on the board and he says, "This is done wrong."
Oh, really? The one that you messed up on?
Yeah. This one is done wrong, but that's all right. I can show you why it went wrong. But outside of that, every one of the problems that I turned in, so I got about, as far as my homework was concerned, I did my 99.9999% correct all along the line. And so there was only two B's given out in the class, and I got one of them. And in those days, there was only three grades, a 3 for an A, a 2 for a B, a 1 for a C, and D was 0, and F was a minus 1 in determining your grade point.
How important did you and your parents consider grades?
My parents never dug at me about it. I'd be told from time to time, "You're out to the university to learn," but that's as far as it went. And my grades were relatively poor during my first 2 years, but they picked up markedly when I got to be a junior and senior, because I learned how to study.
Mm-hmm. And you were in something getting
to. Yes, and I had got by what was called the survey courses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you think your experience might have been similar to other students, and that you did poorer in those first 2 years in the survey courses. Did they grade on like a bell-shaped curve, you know, or did they do any of those things?
I don't know. The grading system, it was reported that some of the professors graded by taking all the final exams or all of the exam papers in one big bundle and standing at the top of the stairs, mm-hmm. throw them down, and then those that landed on the top got an A, and as you got down, they got to be an F. They were mostly done on the basis of, let's say, 89 to 100 was an A, and then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
On final exams, did you have an exam break before exams?
You know? No.
So you go right from classes right into finals.
Mm-hmm.
What format were they given? Were they generally essays?
It largely depended upon the course. Now, for instance, Hans Gerth always gave essay type. But, say, in the survey courses, say, for sociology or for psychology, they were always true, false, or multiple choice.
That's interesting. Unless they hit them that far back. Were they, how long were they? How much time did you have?
Well, we usually, the final exam was usually an hour and a half. It was two periods. If you got it done ahead of time, okay.
It was two periods. Mean they didn't have special exam time set aside?
The exam period was a certain week.
Okay.
And that's all there was exams. And your exam would be from 10 to 12, or it would be from 1 to 3, or okay, something in that order.
Okay. Were special exam booklets provided?
We had, I don't know what they're using now, but we had what they call a blue book.
Yeah, they're still using them. That's what I wanted to know. Was there such a thing as an open book or take-home exam?
Never a take-home exam. I never had an open book one, although I did have one or two exams where we were able to use notes. We could bring in a notebook with things in it.
Sort of variation of the open book.
Yeah.
That was only one.
Yeah.
Might anyone besides your professor grade the exams?
I think the TA did it. I don't know for sure, but I'm sure the TA did it. Did the statistics exam?
Were exams generally proctored?
Yes.
By whom? Do you know?
The professor and his assistants.
As far as you know, was cribbing ever a major problem for the professors?
No, I don't think so. There was. I'm sure there was some of it.
What about final exams, final grades? Were they generally mailed, posted? Inadvertently?
They were mailed.
Mm-hmm. You didn't have any lab equipment?
No, the only thing I had lab equipment was in the statistic lab, where we had the original type computers. First of the computers, which were quite a large machine, they would add, subtract, multiply, and divide, and that's what they would do.
So they're like the ones that you could buy for $5.95 down at
Safco
now, essentially, except about 5,000 times its size.
Yes, they would be very large. They would be as big as a regular electric typewriter, even bigger.
Of the professors you had, which were the best teachers?
Who were the best teachers? I think I had a pretty good group. Now, for instance, McCormick, who was the head of the sociology department, and he was a statistician. His lectures were as dead as a doornail. He'd sit up there and talk to us about the things, and if we had any questions, there was a little exchange in his lectures because he had to explain a good many things, and sometimes it wouldn't get across, but they were extremely dull and dry. And then there was a man by the name of Howard Becker, who lectured. He later became, after McCormick retired, he became head of the. I saw three men as head of the Department of Sociology. There was Gillen, and then McCormick, and then Howard Becker. And When I got there, Professor Gillen was a very old man, but he was still head of the department, and he was a very gentle person, and he lectured, he did well with us. But Howard Becker was colorful. Mm-hmm. He would read Winnie the Pooh to us.
To what end?
Well, supposedly it was to be connected with his lecture. Mm-hmm. But he would. It was done many, many times during a semester. And then he would take off on it a little bit, and take the sociological approach, and give us a little insight into it. And I'll never forget the day he came with a great big bandage on his hand. He got up on the podium, up on the little stage. We were all out there. There was about 30 of us in the lecture class. It was. Let's put it this way: one of the courses that you had to take in order to be a major in sociology. Mm-hmm. So it was very important that you. Everybody was there and everything. Well, he stood there and held his hand up like this with all a big bandage on it, and he said. I did this on a lathe, and I didn't put the guard on it. I was making a submarine for my son, and I didn't put the guard on my lathe. And he says, if any of you had come in and told me that you did what I did, I would say he was an idiot and didn't belong in this class. He was a very fine lecturer, he covered an awful lot of territory in a very, very short time, and gave you awful lot of facts, and you take notes like a madman.
Did any of the professors that you have ever talk much about their research?
No. Mm-hmm. Although Becker has got his name on a book, V.C. Becker, Systematic Sociology.
Did you ever hear the term skyrocketing?
Nope, not all, except on Camp Randall.
Okay, so you didn't do skyrockets for professors?
No.
Okay. Kind of early, I'm trying to figure out exactly why.
Well, we used to clap for them once in a while.
No, that ain't the same, let me tell you. It was just this sort of, it sounded like a cheerleader type cheer that professors would get at various times of the semester in the class. And it sounds like some of these teachers might have been ones who would be candidates for skyrockets at an earlier.
Well, you see what I think that kind of went out when the war came on, because the number of males was exceedingly small, mm-hmm. and the girls were a little bit shy about doing that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's
definitely different. It's definitely an interesting change there. Track that down and back a little further. You said that you lived at home for all of your years.
Yes.
Okay, so you commuted via how? How did you get to and from?
Well, I always took the bus to the campus from here, and let's say most of the time I took the bus home from the campus, but frequently I used to walk.
Would you generally spend the day down on campus?
Yes, I'd go in the morning and come back, five or 5:30 in the afternoon. I'd leave in the morning at maybe 6:30, come back about 5.
Where would you generally eat lunch?
On campus, Toby and Moon's, to be precise.
Tell me about Toby and Moon's.
Well, it was a restaurant that was located right next door to where your, let's see, what's the name of that place now? Brathouse.
No.
Where the Brathouse is now. wasn't always there. But Toby Moons was right next door. It was a couple of ex-football players run the place.
That's Toby and Moon?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And, well, it was a good restaurant. It was no booze, no nothing like that, just stools at a counter. Mm-hmm. And you get everything from soup to dessert for 35 cents.
Oh, so you pay 35 cents for the lunch, and then you get the whole spiel.
You could also get a steak there for a T-bone steak for 75 cents.
Oh, I don't even hear about that. That's amazing. I can't even look at one now for five times that. So you would go almost every day to Moon, what's it again?
Yeah, Toby.
Toby and Moon's. Was there a regular lunch crowd that went there?
Oh, yes.
So
it was males.
Mm-hmm.
Males only, really. I can't say that I ever saw a girl in there.
Was that by law or just by tradition?
Just, most of the girls went over to the Memorial Union or they went back to their dormitory.
Okay. Now, did this continue throughout the war the same way?
Yes.
What about any other places on State Street? Any other stores? Or it doesn't have to be restaurants.
Well, there was the Rennebaum's drugstore was there.
Mm.
Always has been, as long as I can. 1937, when I started, it was there, and it's still there now. Up the block a ways, towards the square, maybe just a couple doors, was a fairly decent-sized restaurant called Lawrence's.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I was there all those years and never was in there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the garbage piled up in front of it after the St. Patrick's Day parade.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But I can't say that I ever was in the place.
Were there other restaurants around there?
Yes.
Did Rennie serve food?
Yes. I don't think as much as they do now. It wasn't as food-oriented as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
There was a hamburger place called Wimpy's, which before that was a White Tower hamburger place, and that was right in back of where Brown's Bookstore is. I used to go there once in a while. They had hot chili that I liked.
Mm. You said that the girls went to the Union or to the dorms. Was there any kind of a... can you make any kind of generalizations about who ate in the Union and who ate in different restaurants? Or is that impossible?
Well, let's put it this way. Toby and Moon's was... all they did there was really the food was cheap and they talked football year-round.
Okay. So that was that a jock hangout then? And people just interested in athletics?
Yeah.
But athletes went there too?
Oh, yes. In fact, they always had the athletes working behind the counter. You heard, maybe you've heard of Fred Gage?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he worked behind the counter there. And there were other football players behind the counter. In those days, they were smaller. But it was oriented towards sports. And, the girls weren't greatly interested in it. But, and it was a small place.
Yeah. Okay. That's very interesting. So you didn't, did you have any part-time jobs at all there?
Yes, I had two jobs. They grew out of the same thing. It was over at the Memorial Union. One of them was that they had a little studio above the theater, and they had they gave me a bunch of records. Ralph Ginsberg and let's see, now what was it? Ralph Ginsberg's trio, violin, viola, and bass. And they gave me a whole bunch of records, and they were all 78s. And the equipment, of course, then was nothing like what we've got now. And I'd play records, and they would, and it would be come out down in the Crip Commons, and I had no idea of the volume that it was coming down there from up there. And I'd get a telephone call. It's too loud. It isn't loud enough.
So you sort of have to estimate at what would be the right volume.
Yeah.
How did you get that job?
Well, I got it through, now let's see, what was his name now? He got to be ticket manager down at the Oscar Damon. Oscar Damon run the desk at the Memorial Union at that time. He was there for years. And he put me on to that job. And then I took tickets for the graduate dance that they had every Saturday night. I took tickets for that.
Was that your second part-time job?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you get that through Oscar Damon also?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I wasn't. I did one, and then I did the other. You know, they weren't both at the same time.
How much time did you actually spend in the morning besides work?
Well, I spent a great deal of time there on weekends.
Doing what and where?
Friday night, I went to the dances up in Great Hall. They had a dance up there every Friday night. I went up there every Friday night.
Did that tradition continue all the way through your
days? Pretty much. It kind of died down a bit. For instance, Great Hall, somehow or another, didn't attract people later on. It was very strong when I started and went through the war years. But I used to go up there to dance at one night a week, mostly during the fall season. And then later in the year, I would... I used to bowl, and I used to play pool. I remember the man who ran the, he had a little tobacco place down by the pool tables, down on the ground floor. Now, what do they call that? The Paul Bunyan room and that kind of thing. Well, they had this little stand where he sold tobacco products, and he had a case with pipes in it and that kind of thing. And I used to go down there and play pool, and right around the corner was a bowler. They had bowling. I used to go over there and bowl. So between those three things, and besides, I got into the concert committee, and I used to attend concerts, and have committee meetings in the Memorial Union. I spent a lot of time in the Memorial Union. Mm-hmm.
Was that typical of most students, you think? Was that a fairly big hangout?
Yes, it was a hangout. There was a large number of students there, always.
Were there any other places on and off campus that you and your friends might go just to hang out or relax?
Well, there was a campus soda grill, which was in the middle of the 600 block on State Street. It was a soda fountain primarily. They served the best malts and all around for 25 cents. Real fine malt, all kinds of ice cream and that kind. He did have a small bar. They sold beer, but it never was a drinking place. It was a place to go and get a ice cream or any sort of sandwiches. It was a place for that.
Okay.
We spent a lot of time in there, and about two doors down was a place called Lohmeyer's, and that was strictly a beer place. And that place, we were standing in one another's feet. It was so thick in there. That was beer. And it was a hubbub and... well, a good time we had by all. Boys and girls, it was all... those two places that I've mentioned so far, it was boys and girls, and we're all mixed up together. And it was a... Everybody was having a good time. No fights, no nothing. It was, but everybody was happy, and they had over at Lohmeyer's. You got all the popcorn you could eat, and with your beer, and you could guzzle all you wanted.
Was the log cabin still around at that point?
Yes, the log cabin was.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. I used to be able to get two brats or two steaks for a quarter and a carton of milk for 10 cents, 30, that'd be 35. Two sandwiches and a carton of milk for 35 cents. Two brats or two steak sandwiches.
Was that a popular hangout for
students? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That was, it was very small, but... And it was usually stuffed in the evening.
Did professors ever go in any of these places? Sort of off limits to professors.
Well, I had heard of them going to the log cabin. However, I never ran across any down there.
Where did they go? Professors?
University Club.
Mm-hmm. Let's see.
Well, I would say there's another place that deserves mention. It was called the Amber Inn.
Okay. Amber?
Yeah. And it was located in the 400 block of State Street. On the same side of the street as, well, what would be considered the north side of State Street.
And was that another eatery?
No.
Drinkery?
It was a let's put it this way, a little bit fancier place to go and drink. Lohmeyer's was beer. This place up there, you could get wine or gin buck or whatever you wanted. And they had booths and tables and besides the barstool.
Can you recall any of the fads and hobbies that were popular during your college years?
No, not really. The Hoofers were going at that time.
Yeah,
they've been going a long time. I never had anything to do with them, but I know they were there. But there wasn't, my era, the students, for the most part, didn't have much money. There wasn't much money among them. Especially the Wisconsin students. That was another, the New York people always seem to have better clothes, more money to spend, that kind of thing. Another source of jealousy, so to speak. But we had... No, I really can't say I remember any fads or anything. There was... didn't have what are these things they throw nowadays?
Yeah, it
didn't have any of that kind of thing.
Okay. Were there any books, certain books that everyone was reading that were very popular in these years?
Well, I'll tell you, there was a very naughty book that was kept under lock and key in the university library, and that was called Lady Chatterley's Lovers.
Oh, yes.
And everybody took turns in going up there and reading that.
I mean, you could get it out. You just had to go up there.
Yeah, you could sit there and read and read, and people would go, and you had to return it.
That day, while you were sitting, you just got to read it in a room.
Yeah. it was one of those things.
Yeah. That's interesting. What were the movie idols? Who were the movie idols? Do you remember anyone in particular?
No.
What about the radio shows? Were there any that were real popular?
On campus, I think they were more into records than they were into anything else.
What record?
They had symphonies and that kind of thing.
What about like Dorsey and Goodman? Weren't those real hot on campus?
No. They were on the jukeboxes, but you go up to a friend's room, and he had a stack of symphonies.
And that's what you listen to?
Yeah.
Okay. Changing to the Cardinal. Did you read the Cardinal?
No. Uh-uh. It was regarded as being a mouthpiece for... the Eastern establishment, and we don't bother with it.
Oh, was your opinion generally? Do you think that's the general opinion that a lot of your friends had?
Yeah, that was the general opinion of a lot of my friends. I didn't except when I was on the concert committee. The Daily Cardinal was something that we had to contend with, because the Daily Cardinal would usually come out. Regardless of how well our performers performed, they would find something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, I'll put it this way, we didn't exactly admire them.
Okay. Describe a typical date. Where would you go?
Well, a typical date would be either a performance in the theater in the Memorial Union, or that small theater that's down there, where the very small one where they show pictures.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah.
It was usually foreign films there. We either one of those two places, and then we'd go over to the Campus Soda Grill. Usually took your girl to the Campus Soda Grill and treat her to a good one of those good sodas or sundaes. Mm-hmm. There. The girls had, if they lived in a dormitory, which was standard, they on weeknights they had to be in at 10 o'clock. If they weren't in at 10 o'clock, the doors were locked on them. And then they had to tap at the door, and they were recorded as to what time they came in. And
what about weekend did they get later?
Weekend they got 12:30.
Now, I had one gentleman sing the song something about the lights on Observatory Hill. Was that a commonplace to take dates for kind of like kissing and things like that?
Yep.
Now, I heard later on that Picnic Point became the place to go. I'm trying to figure out when the transition occurred. Was it still Observatory Hill during your...
It was still Observatory Hill when I was around on campus.
Okay.
But there were so few around in my day up there. Until they built Liz Waters.
Mm-hmm.
Liz Waters brought too much population up there. Mm-hmm. It didn't mind if there was two couples sitting on this long ledge that was on the astronomy building there. It didn't matter that there was two couples sitting there, they were in perfect sight of one another. That didn't matter. But when they built Liz Waters and there was cars and dozens of people coming by, that kind of killed it.
Yeah. What were the prevailing student attitudes toward alcohol?
Well, it was there, and if you and they guzzled a lot of beer. And they would stuff the amber in. But you didn't see a drunken student very often.
But there wasn't a, you didn't look down on students who had a beer now and then?
No.
What about girls? Did they do the same thing? Did they have some beer, several beer, and not get drunk? So did they go in and have a beer without any?
Oh, yes. No problem. No questions asked, and no hassle.
What about tobacco?
The girls smoked, and I never heard any bad remarks about it.
And men, it was typical. Tobacco was accepted.
Yeah.
What about drugs?
Not that I know of. Not to my knowledge.
Okay. And what was the prevailing attitude towards sex?
Well, it was whoopee. Let's put it this way. I didn't run across any overt kind of thing until the sailors came in during the war. I'll tell you a story. I got to know one of the janitors in the historical library building. Okay. Well, on the front part of that faces the mall, there's those great big wide pillars.
Mm-hmm.
And then back of that is a set of doors. Okay. This janitor took me in, and he and another fellow with me. And he said, I want to show you something tonight. I'm going to set you down out here in back of these windows here. He says, people can't see you in there, but you can see out there to what's going on. The sailors used to bring their girls up and prop them up against those big wide pillars there on, between the door and the...
Oh, my God.
Close.
Times change, don't they?
Well, up until that time, I'm sure that there was sex going on, but
it wasn't talked about.
No, it wasn't talked about, and there was nothing, and none of this living together as,
mm-hmm. Were intramural sports popular on campus?
There was some touch football and there was some baseball, I remember.
Were you involved in any of those?
No.
What were the most, rank the major spectator sports in terms of popularity? Like 1 through 3.
One was boxing. As far as filling, filling the facility, that field house holds about 12,000 people, and they had the boxing team would perform there, and that place would be just jammed every time. Back in the early 40s, we had an NCAA basketball championship here, and basketball was popular then, and of course football was always there, and it had its popularity too. As far as filling the facility, mm-hmm. from that angle, boxing was number one, and basketball was number two, and football was number three. Hockey hadn't come into existence yet.
In which sports was Wisconsin perceived as a national power?
Boxing. Yeah, you bet they were.
Big Ten power?
National.
That's the next question. What about a Big Ten power? Which sports would Wisconsin perceive as Big Ten power? Boxing, of course, since they were national. But what about basketball or football? Were they Big Ten powers in either one of those?
Yes, they got to be the time of Alan Ameche and Pat Harder.
Mm-hmm.
They were in football. But back in the 40s... with the team of England, with England and Cotts, Shiway, Reams, they were Big Ten champions, and also they were national champions at that time.
Was it common to take dates to sporting events?
I really can't say. I know the girls went. Whether they went as dates, I don't know.
What were the major social events of the year?
Well, of course, the prom.
Mm-hmm.
In the fall of the year, we had there was a lot of things going on at the Memorial Union, and also the fraternities and the sororities all held open house from time to time, and this was a big social event. This was it. The sororities and fraternities held open house, not necessarily on the same weekend, but five or six of them would have it this weekend, and five or six more would have it the next weekend, and there'd be a few each week during the fall time of the year.
Did you attend those?
I used to go to the sororities.
Tell me how that went. What would you do?
Well, all it was the girls were all dressed up, just beautiful, you know, long dresses and
so formal type dresses,
cocktail type.
Cocktail, okay.
Yeah. Or a real nice dress, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was, and they usually had a little dance band, and they had a dance floor. Most of these places had a room that they were old houses, and they had very large living rooms, and so there was room to dance, and they served old snack foods, no alcohol. And there was coffee or tea,
and so it just
gives
a chance to. Meet the girls, see mm-hmm. the house.
That's right.
Would there be tours or anything like that?
No tours. You
would all take part in the parlor?
All take part in the parlor, so to speak.
Okay. Would they go outdoors if the weather was nice, or was it done indoors?
It was done indoors all the time.
Okay. We talked about your part-time job. Let's see how we're doing. I think I'm going to stop it here and put in a... Mr. Worth, we're beginning side three of the interview. What role did religion play in your life as a student?
Well, it was pretty important. On an informal basis. Now, I was born and raised a Catholic, and so I used to go down to the Catholic Youth Center. That's what they called it in those days. And there was a Father Cachera down there who was
Catholic Youth Center, something run by the university? Excuse
no, no, no. It, oh, okay. it was St. Paul's Chapel.
Okay.
You probably know it as.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Father Cachera ran the place at the time. And he was something else. He dressed and very much of a free spirit. Very much, he dressed like the students did in the 69-70, and this was way back in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
He was bearded, he wore, his clothes were usually disheveled and none too clean. He was, I don't know, he was just different. He was on the order of Hans Gerth,
mm-hmm.
Cut out of the same kind of cloth. Very pragmatic type person, and it was a pleasure to know him, because you could say anything to him you wanted to, and he would talk to you, and he'd talk on your level. If mm-hmm. if you didn't know what you was talking about, why, he would kind of straighten you around, but gently.
Was this a place, the youth center, that many students went?
Oh yes, quite a few.
So was his, trying to figure out, did he have a parish?
Yes.
Of regular citizens, yes, in the city, and then he also had students who would come.
No, that was his parish.
Oh, the students were his parish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see. Okay. 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 So that's the new St. Paul's is where the center used to be, but it wasn't a part of the campus.
No, it was in the same location.
Okay.
The press house was on the corner, the St. Paul's Chapel, and Student Center was in the middle, and over on the other side was the Methodist Church.
So how often would you go to church?
Well, it wasn't exactly church. I'd go down there once in a while, not often for entertainment or that kind of thing, but I'd... I'd run across something in class that I wanted to have a discussion with somebody who I felt knew something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go down and talk with him. And very well, a very highly educated man. And he, as I say, he was a pragmatist.
Mm-hmm.
And that permeated everything that he talked to you about, his pragmatic view of everything. And so we would, I used to like to talk to him about Max Weber's Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, which is the name of a book that Max Weber wrote, Hans Gerth, for instance, was one of those people who started to translate many of these German books and give us chapters out of it. It was very interesting. His translations were very imperfect, but you get something out of it anyway.
Getting back to the Catholic Center, were there a lot of other students involved in this?
Oh yes, he dealt with students from say 7 o'clock in the morning until 2 o'clock in a.m.
I get the picture. Would he do a lot of counseling? Those types,
yes,
of
things? He did lots and lots and lots of counseling besides his duties in the church, saying mass and hearing confessions and all that kind of stuff.
Were there a lot of Catholics on campus?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, fair representation.
Yes, fair representation, that's for sure.
Okay. Let's turn for a second to student government. Were you ever involved in student government?
No. Uh-huh. Never.
What did you know about it as a student?
It was there, but so what?
You really didn't think of it as a very effective organization?
Right? No, it was regarded as being, well, just kind of a nothing activity.
Okay. And was that by you or by other people as well?
Well, the young fellows that I was with, we didn't pay any attention to the student government at all. We didn't vote in their elections. We didn't go to their meetings. We didn't do nothing.
Okay. What about the 20s and 30s saw several radical, quote-unquote, political student groups on campus? Were you associated with these groups, or did you have any opinions on them? Were you aware of them? Or?
Well, there was the Young Socialist Group. I went to hear Norman Thomas one mm-hmm. time, and he was a marvelous speaker. Didn't necessarily agree with him, but I was glad I went.
Mm-hmm.
And they passed around a paper, sign your name for this petition. Even then I wouldn't sign my name on petitions. I at least on that level, on the Norman Thomas, He ran for president so many times that four or five times at least. I heard a very fine speaker, and Norman Thomas was a good man. I didn't necessarily have to agree with him.
Were you aware of these other political groups on campus? Did you pay them any mind at all, or did you just decide from the citizen that they were discussing?
No. They didn't create any ripple at all.
Okay.
There wasn't anything going on. There would be speakers, but who would attend? A dozen or so, you know. The bulk of the students didn't pay any attention to the more radical, although Norman Thomas filled up the music hall. Ran for president once too often, and everybody knew him.
What about, you mentioned that you were involved with the concert committee. Before we get to that, were there any other clubs or organizations that you were involved with?
No, just the concert committee, and I was on the orientation committee the 1 year.
Okay, tell me about the concert committee. How did you get chosen? Were you elected? Did you volunteer?
I frankly don't know how I got involved with it. I know I went out and sought them out and said, hey, look, can you use somebody on your committee? They took me in. It was mostly New York.
What did you do?
Well, I was the gopher. If posters were to be put up all over the campus, I was the one who carried them around and put them up. Mm-hmm. I was the one who went over and got the program mm-hmm. from the musicians, like the Pro Arte Quartet. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Pro Arte Quartet used to rehearse on the stage in Music Hall, and you know the old building there, mm-hmm. and they'd sit on the stage there and rehearse, and I'd go over there to get the program, and they'd be sawing away on their fiddles, and one thing another, and I'd sit down and listen to them, and when they'd get done, why I'd go and get the program from them. I enjoyed it. I used to be astonished at those men up there because sometimes they play something and they laugh and clap and they just have the grandest little time all by themselves. And then again, they would they'd be sawing away on their fiddles and tears would be running down their eyes. They would be crying and playing at the same time. Very, very emotional group. I'd sit over and watch them, and when they got done, I'd get the program and go back. And then somebody would draw up the posters and have them printed, and I'd take them around.
Now, on the concert committee, did you have anything to do with selecting people who came also?
Oh, not really. I know I sat in on meetings where we kind of decided we're going to have this person or that person or the most of the people on the concert committee were in the School of Music, and I figured they knew more about music than I did.
But it was your committee that decided who would come.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's right.
Okay. And which concert series is this for? The Union concert series?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a very important. How many people were on the committee?
I think there was about 10 of us all told.
And you were all students?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did you elect the chairman then?
I frankly don't remember. Okay. I remember one fellow who used to come, and he'd on a table, he'd unfold a piano keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have the meeting going, and he'd be going like this. I thought he was nuts. But I didn't say nothing.
Maybe he was. Okay, getting into some miscellaneous campus concerns. Name and characterize, if you could, the Dean of Men and the Dean of Women for the years that you were on campus.
I frankly had nothing to do with the Dean of Men. I never got in any trouble.
Is that why you usually went to the Dean of Men? Why one usually went? Because you were one was in trouble?
Yes.
Okay. So he was a disciplinarian in many
ways.
Yeah.
Okay. He was one that you were summoned to.
Summoned to.
And the same is true of the Dean of Women. Okay, the Dean of Women, I can't tell you who she was.
Is that
but,
Troxel?
Huh?
Troxel? Is that ring a bell? Or Greeley?
Greeley, that rings a bell.
It's the same person. It's just a married name. So,
it is?
Well, let's just, this isn't, so we're talking, just tell me what year you're referring to approximately.
Oh, maybe that. About 42.
Okay, go ahead. Listen.
But she was regarded as a battle axe. Now, for instance, I had Professor Otto had a little room above the stage, Baskin Theater, and it was very small room for a desk and two chairs, a file cabinet, and a clothes tree. Okay. Professor Otto gave me the key to it and said, well, you can go up there and do your reading, and it's a good place. And also I was involved in guidance work. I was helping Professor Edgerton at the time administer tests and one thing or another up there. Well, anyway, I used to have these girl readers up there. And here... We'd be very close proximity, and bare legs up to here, and there I was, listening, and at 21, this was, so I took up pipe smoking in order to keep my hands off from, because if a girl reported you to the Dean of Women, you're liable to find yourself out of the university.
They didn't futz around at all. They didn't fool around when they got you in there.
Nope. No, sir. There was no fooling around.
Was it the same feeling about the Dean of Women? If you were summoned to the Dean of Women, that usually meant that you were you had done something wrong?
Yes.
How did women feel about her, do you know?
No, I don't know how the women felt. I knew that the women... didn't hesitate to run to him if they had something that they wanted to complain about.
Okay, and that's how your one professor got in trouble.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Word that one point. Did you have any personal contact with any of the other deans on campus? LNS, engineering, ag?
No.
Who was the president during your term?
Frank and Dykstra.
Can you talk about either one of them? Did you have any encounters with them or anything
about Frank, them? No, I didn't. I can't recall that I ever saw him.
Yeah, he was just sort of leaving when you came.
Yes. But Dykstra was there, and I remember he was very often, his office was right up in Baskin Hall at that time, and very often he would... he had an entourage with him all the time, but he would be out in front of Baskin Hall talking with a group. He mingled with the students a bit.
What did you and your friends have an opinion of him as an administrator? Did you feel he was a good president or a bad president, or didn't you care or know?
No, we really weren't concerned. He was a president in the university, and he was running it, and he wasn't standoffish or anything like mm-hmm. that, and so he was accepted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. That's all right. Did you ever have any contact with any of the regents?
No.
Okay. We already talked about the merchants and citizens in Madison. What kind of relationship did you and the other students have generally with the merchants in Madison?
It was very good. State Street was a real... there were all different kinds of stores up and down State Street. There was men's clothing stores, women's clothing stores, even a fur store on campus. Right up and down State Street, and a lot of them. And jewelry stores and what have you, all up and down State Street. And... let's put it this way: the students patronized State Street. Mm-hmm. The girls wanted dresses; they were up on State Street. They got them out of the dress shops there. And as far as men's clothing was concerned, there was up closer to the square. There was two or three men's clothing stores, and the students men got clothes up there. However, most of the students came on campus with most of their clothes. Mm-hmm. The girls would come, by the way, they'd have trunk after trunk after trunk full of clothes. Lots of clothes. They just came loaded with clothes. And, I know that because I was around down on Langdon Street when they were in the fall, when they were moving in and moving out of Langdon Hall, for instance, corner of Langdon and Lake. The KK Club is in the basement of it now. And then there was the Ann Emery, which was up at the corner of... Francis and Langdon. Big building up there.
So the merchants made out very well from the students in Madison.
Oh, yes.
Was there a pretty good feeling between the merchants and the students?
Oh, yes. There was no complaint about
it. Okay. That's interesting. Now, you talk about you were there in the pre-war years and into the war. What differences... what effect did the war have on your life as a student?
Well, one, it kind of it reduced the activity on the campus. That is the density of the activity. You could go up and down State Street on a Saturday morning, and you wouldn't see anybody around. Can't do that now.
Mm-hmm.
And there was empty classrooms. I could tell you stories about the empty classrooms over in Science Hall. That'd be interesting. That's one thing I should tell you about. But there was a lot of empty classrooms all over. Of course, the number of female students was very great. That kind of changed the... it reduced the... do you want to be a badger, rah, rah, rah business
mm-hmm.
on campus? The girls, that was a male activity. The girls would join in with the guys, but for them to come out with it, it wasn't spontaneous with them like
so
it was with the fellows.
So school spirit sort of went down a little bit, or
yes.
became more muted.
Yes. Sure, the girls liked their university too, but they weren't the kind of, the girls just didn't express it in the same way mm-hmm. that the fellas did.
What about the soldiers? How did their appearance change?
Well, they were a spectacular kind of thing. I told you about the one incident about the sailors and
mm-hmm. historic.
Yeah, historic. Okay, when we had once we had a minor riot at the Campus Soda Grill. The sailors, there was a whole bunch of sailors, and they were young, very, very young. There was a black man sitting at the bar in the Campus Soda Grill. And they were just raising hell outside. They sent for the shore patrol.
You mean that the sailors were raising hell simply because there was a black man sitting in
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
eating
it. And they were mostly Southern boys.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded probably sounded uglier than what it was, but the shore patrol came, and they all had their clubs, and they ordered them away. And after a little argument, why they dispersed, but it took the shore patrol a whole truckload of them. To disperse them.
I wonder if that was Madison's first race riot.
The thing of it was that it was not regarded as a race riot.
What was it regarded as?
Just an unfortunate incident is what it was regarded as. I was there. I was. Oh well, I stayed about 25-40 feet away from the entrance, but I was there during the entire incident. It was nasty, but we were not oriented towards thinking of a person being racist
mm-hmm.
or that kind in that kind of way.
What were you oriented? What were you? What did you think instead of racist?
Well, we said, what went through most of our minds, and we talked about it. There was more than I was with several friends, and we talked about it, and we thought, well, those guys from down there and down south must be awful ignorant. Carry on that way. It was perfectly accepted here.
And there was absolutely, just so we get this clear for the record, there was absolutely no feeling that that black man didn't have, shouldn't have been there in the first place.
No,
I mean, you
absolutely.
Just felt that that was fine. That was a common occurrence.
Yes.
A black man sitting here. Okay, fine.
But these guys from the South.
It was their reaction that created the whole incident.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
I see.
And,
Was that the only incident that you can think of?
That's the only incident of that nature. We did not, and we didn't condemn those people as being racist. We just thought they were awfully stupid.
Mm-hmm. I have a strong suspicion that their commanding officer may have had similar discussions with them later that evening, which
yeah.
could be why you never heard anything more.
Well, listen, I like to tell you a funny story. We also had a whole great big group of waves. Mm-hmm. These female sailors. They had the old Chadburn Hall before they built mm-hmm. the new one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's where they were housed. Okay. Now, I happened to be down in front of the old. Uh, uh, well, the chemistry building, and right there by Charter, Charter and University. And here comes a whole line of waves. One girl out on the side, yelling, going hop, 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 and one out in front, leading them, and they were marching down the sidewalk, two by two. Comes a shower, started to rain, and they were all in dress uniforms. Comes a shower. They scattered like like buckshot and got underneath the trees. And the one who was in charge of the group stood out on the sidewalk and screamed at them, "Assemble! Assemble!" The girl didn't pay any attention to her whatsoever. Finally, she just kind of looked daggers at him and went out and stood under a tree herself until it stopped raining.
Did they always, do the soldiers in Waves and Wax always march?
Yes.
From place to place?
That's right.
So what was the, did you mingle at all? Did the citizens, students mingle much with the soldiers, military students?
No.
So there was no fraternization?
Oh, there was, say, on a classroom level. Sometimes when there would be some of them in a class.
Okay. But otherwise, not socially.
No.
Did they hang around the Memorial Union much?
There was some of them around the Memorial Union.
Where did they generally go?
I don't know. They had their own recreation halls and one to another.
In the dorms, I suppose.
Yes, in the dorms. That's right. Frankly, I don't know. They weren't around that much. You noticed them marching from class to class. But outside of a couple here and a couple there from time to time, you didn't notice them.
So they kept a pretty low profile.
Yeah, very low profile.
When you graduated from UW, what were your career goals?
Well, I tell you, when I got through over in the sociology department, and I was supposed to be able to be a social worker. When I got done with the course, I didn't want to be a social worker anymore.
Yeah, that's unheard of.
Well, so I went into a related field. That's how I got over in the School of Education with Dr. Edgerton. I went and started to in as vocational counseling on a high school level. Well, all I needed was a few courses in order to be able to go into high school as a teacher. What happened to me was that I got in an automobile accident and I got myself all beat up and I was laid up for 2 years. So that changed my whole career, so to speak. So I went into the restaurant business at the Forest Products for 32 years.
Oh, is that where you were? What are your in other words, your education didn't really prepare you for your career?
No.
For your subsequent career then?
No, but it was useful.
In a direct sense, yeah. In an indirect sense.
I just want to record right here that I do not regret spending the years that I did at the university.
I think that should be very obvious to anyone who listens to this in the future. Last question. What are your current thoughts on the quality and scope of the education you received at UW?
Well, I think that I received a better education than the young people who are there at the present time, let's say in the School of L&S. Engineering and law, I don't know anything about. But let's put it this way. The L&S students, I don't think, are getting as much is what I got.
In what ways do you think you benefited more than the current students?
I think the level of scholarship that was demanded of us in those days was greater than it is now. I'll give an example, and this is very current. This happened yesterday. Here is this 21-year-old girl. I think I don't know what she is at the, or what school she's in. I think she probably is in Phi Ed or something, or some related field where she has quite a bit. Has to take Phi Ed, you know, as part of the I think. I said to her, "Well, you're rather pragmatic." Well, she, "What's that?" She didn't know what the word pragmatic meant. And she's 21 years old, 3 years at the university, and doesn't know what the word pragmatic
meant. Not much one can do and say in defense of something like that.
And it's been little incidents like that along the line that I don't think the scholarship is as great now as it was then, or not emphasized. And as an excuse, I can give the university an excuse. It's a whole lot easier to demand scholarship out of a class of say 50 or 60 students than it is out of one of 400.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think size is a big factor. Well, we'll carry. I better wrap this thing up here. I've been speaking again with Mr. Charles C. Worth from Madison, Wisconsin, who attended the university from 1937 till 1944. And we are March 13th, 1984. We are now concluding this interview.